accession number 20935, Reel 2.
That is Gibson, Reel 2.
Yes, the 1st Battalion, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, was part of Nunnan Brigade. They called it the International Brigade because we had the 2nd Ulster Rifles and the 2nd Lincolns, which made up the brigade. There was a lot of competition between the regiments, being English, Irish and Scottish. This was Montgomery's old div. He was a commander at one time of the 3rd Infantry Division, and he designed the divisional sign, which was a black triangle with a red triangle reversed inside. The Germans called this the sign of the dripping blood. They had a lot of casualties before they captured Caen, and that's why they took quite a few reinforcements from other regiments and that, you know. So we lost our border regiment badge and were given the badge of the King's Own Scottish Borderers, which I found out later was a very nice badge, and lots of style in the regiment, with the Glengarries and the cock feather in your hat, you know, and marching to pipes and drums and this sort of thing. The next thing was, I think the next thing we went into was the Fallet Gap, where the 10th German Army was surrounded. We moved up to, I forgot the name of the sector, I know, because being foot soldiers, you went across fields and sometimes you didn't know whereabouts you were. It's not like going down the road where you can see a sign and tell you that you're here, you know. We had quite a few casualties there. I was with my old corporal, who I was always with, you know. Little Harry, he was with me as well. I think he was doing a number two on the Bren gun, so that meant he had to carry extra magazines in his pouches, which was sometimes very awkward if you had to hit the deck pretty quick. He couldn't really get down. And I remember we were going across these hedges, and I know the Germans was on the high ground, and they were sending a lot of mortar bombs over. When we finally took these dug, it was sort of a concrete dugout, and they were marked out so that the mortars could aim on this mark, and they could hit any part of the outline area, which was mostly hedges and that. And I remember one came down, and Harry and I hit the ground together. Harry couldn't really get down properly because of the pouches, and I was more or less a couple of feet from, was more or less near enough together. And this mortar bomb landed just behind him. Well, when a mortar bomb explodes, the shrapnel go in one direction, and Harry caught the lot in his back. And I remember, because I couldn't really see at the time, and my ears was ringing and that. And all I could see when I finally come to was his pale face, you know. And later on, I found out, off the stretcher bearers took him away, I found out that he had died of, he had about 22 wounds in his back, little Harry. And a bit later on, we moved on, and we came to a sort of a wood on a pretty highish ground it was. And when we got there, the corporal says, right, he said, we'll go up in these woods and see what's happening up here. And he said, follow me. Well, the bank was a bit slippery, you know, it had been raining and that, and half of us were slipping over going up this bank. Anyway, he shot up there, And I got near enough to the top, and there was this terrific bang. And when I looked over the top, he wasn't there. There was just odds and ends laying about. He must have got a direct hit with an 88 millimeter shell. That was Corporal Macrath, his name was. And later on, we had the job of knocking out the 88 millimeter. We were in a bit of a state then because there was so much stuff flying about, and then further on we came to some buildings, and we got held up there by a German Spander just up the roadway. It was a bit awkward trying to get around on the road because one of the chaps, I think it was a sergeant, he put the brain gun round the corner, holding the brain gun round the corner to fire, and of course the Germans shot him in the arm. And he was quite surprised that he'd been shot in the arm, you know. Anyhow, we did knock the Spander out with some mortar fire. You know, we sent quite a few 2-inch mortars over, and it cleared the decks. We pushed on, and then later on we come to these cornfields. One platoon went to the right. I think it was 8th platoon. I was in 9th platoon. I think it was 8th platoon went to the right. They had a Canadian officer in charge, loaned to the regiment from the Canadian Army, and we didn't see them anymore because the whole platoon was taken prisoner. They didn't come back. And our officer was a Canadian as well. It was his friend who was captured with his platoon. And I won't say the words what he said in a joking manner about his friend having his bottle of whiskey in his haversack, you know.
Please tell me the words.
He says, "That cocksucker's got my whiskey in his pack." Which we thought was, a bit out of hand as we had lost a whole platoon. Anyway, we were pinned down in this field. We just couldn't move because they were just clipping the ears of the corn off the top. And my companion at that time was the platoon sniper. Quite a cool character. He said, "Well, I'm not staying here," he says. Of course, I mean, you know, these bullets were just clipping the tops off the corn. And I says, "Well, if you move, you're going to give the position away because you're going to move the cone." And he said, "Sod the position." He said, "I'm getting out of this." But what he'd done, he apparently had gone back to try and find a suitable place to do a bit of sniping, you know. I didn't see him after that. I don't know what happened to him. You know, he could have been killed or what. But he also was a bodyguard for the... for the colonel. He used to do bodyguard for the colonel as well.
What was the name of this place?
I don't actually know. I know it was in connection with the Fallet Gap. I couldn't tell the name because to us they were just fields and, you know, infantry foot soldiers. You don't find names of places, you know. You just keep pushing on. And then after that, they pulled us out. They pulled us out the line. And when we got back to the camp, we had lots of extra food. And, of course, at that time, we used to get these free issue of 50 cigarettes. And there was tons of cigarettes there from the other platoon and sandwiches and this sort of thing, you know. Plenty of food there. There were so many different things happened, you know. Being 56 years ago, it's a bit of a job remembering everything, you know. But I think some things stick in your memory, you know, especially losing your friends and that. I think I think the next main thing which I remember was when we went to cross the Escort Canal in preparation for Market Garden. I remember it was where we were dug in. We left there about, I think it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was rather dark going through these, it seemed like small forests and that, making our way towards the Escort Canal to do a crossing there. I remember we just marching along, keeping everything quiet, you know, in the dark. And I remember suddenly a battery of 75 pounders opening up, just not very far away, and frightened the life out of us. We got down to the Escort Canal. We was dug in actually at the side of the canal, and we was waiting for these collapsible boats to arrive so that we could cross over. By that time we had quite a few new NCOs and that, and the one I'm still friendly with after 50 years is my old sergeant Fred Hartle, who was a corporal then. And I remember we went over, Jerry was sending these moaning minis over, terrible things, because it was more or less blast that killed, you know. I remember when we got over the other side, a medical orderly pushing this chap on a wheelbarrow. He was completely dead because he was purple. His face and that was purple. I reckon he must have been hit with a blast from a moaning mini. I remember this farmhouse blazing away on our left, and we were pushing in. We had a new officer by then, a chap called Lieutenant Taylor, fresh from Blighty. Still wearing his collar and tie, you know, and we were more or less the point section of the platoon, and I remember we were pushing forward. Fred was in the lead, I was behind Fred, and I remember we was going along, we was walking over this field that had just been ploughed. And we could hear the clinking of the chaps' shovels and whatever they had picked, you know, for digging the holes. And I said to Fred, "We better stop them," and you know, because everything was a misty early morning. It was quite dark and misty and damp and horrible feeling it was, you know. And it was pretty quiet at the time. And so we stopped the section, and Fred said, "Pass the word, we've got to keep quiet, you know." So anyway, we knew we were getting near the Germans because the lieutenant had said, you know, "We're not very far away, hush it a bit, you know." And anyway, Fred and I was sort of leading the section, and all of a sudden there was these blooming Germans just popped up out of the mist, you know. They were shouting, Englanders, you know. And next minute, Fred opened up with his Sten gun, and I fired a round off with a rifle. And then we hit the deck because suddenly there was this crossfire tracer from each corner of this field. And we got pinned down all right. And it was only about a couple of foot from our heads, you know, this tracer. And this new lieutenant was shouting, "Give him cover and fire, give him cover and fire," he's shouting, you know. Of course, he had a brain gunner over there with him, and he opened up to try and give us cover and fire. But we just couldn't move, and suddenly there was a figure come crawling up behind us, and he said, "The company commander says you've got to come back, you're too far forward, you know. Because we was near enough into this village that the brigade was going to take." So we sort of managed to get back behind this high mound. And we got there a while. And then the a section of the Ulster Rifles came up and they sort of went forward past us. We finally got into the village after quite a bit of firing and, you know, one thing and another. When we got into the village, I've forgotten the name of it now. The Germans was at the other end of the village and they was flying down the main road with this tracer. But by then it was near enough daylight, so we decided to house ourselves in these houses and that, you know. We got into the houses and we had to wait to see what was happening next. And the corporal then said to us, better get your heads down for a rest, he said, before we move on again. So we were doing sort of 2 hours on and 4 hours off, you know, sleeping on the floor in these houses and that. Some of the lads went up. Well, the house we went into, they must have been collaborators because they had these pictures on the wall of German soldiers and the SS and all this with their swastikas and their arms, and they had their arms around the people who must have lived in this house, you know. So some of the chaps just went up to the main bedroom and got down on the bed, and their boots was covered in mud and everything, but they thought, well, the collaborators, we don't worry about them, you know. And then later on, we got the order to move.
This is across the Escort Canal?
This is across the Escort Canal, yeah. Yeah, and then we finally got into Holland. I think we got into Holland about the 19th of September. By then, the 1st Airborne Division had dropped at Arnhem. We had a battalion in there as well, paras. The Border Regiment had the highest casualties at Arnhem. They lost quite a considerable men from my old regiment, you know, the Border Regiment, and the KOSBs were involved there.
What was your personal involvement?
Our job was to bash a corridor towards Arnhem and hold the site because it was still occupied by the Germans. So when the Paris got into trouble, we got the job of bashing a corridor through, and I think it was a polar bears come through us and went directly to the Paris and pulled the Paris out. We held the corridor open, that was our job. We got cut off twice, and our job was to hold the corridor open whilst they brought the Paris out. I think there was about 2,000 brought out from 10,000 of the men that had dropped.
How much fighting were you in on the corridor?
Quite a bit, because there was quite a lot of resistance there. You know, the patrols would keep coming up and giving us problems, but we didn't hold it for long because once the paras had been rescued, we came out and we went to, our next job was, I think it was called Operation Aintree, was to capture Venray and Venlo, Overloon area. Our job, being nine brigade, was to clear the I think it was called the Log of Heidi Woods. It was near a little village called Smackt. SMAKT, and the little village gave us a lot of problems. There was always plenty of German patrols coming up and giving us a spray of bullets and then they'd disappear again, you know. And night time was the same. they'd start coming up, because they was only on the other side of the field, these Germans. We was dug in at the woods. And, of course, I was right on the edge of the woods with my friend. We dug a hole there. We found an old door from a barn and covered it over with soil and all that, you know. And we was more or less an observation post. And the Germans used to come up at night and start firing this tracer up into the woods. And then I think they had good observation posts there, because we had a communication trench through the woods to the further down, the ground sort of sloped down. And the cooks used to bring us our food up on these 1500 weights. And it was funny, because we used to crawl down these communication trenches, and when you got to the bottom, the cooks would be standing in the dugout with the food just above them, and they'd just slop it in your mess tin and your tea and all the rest of it, like, you know. And sometimes you're lucky to get back with your tea and your mess tin, because the Germans seemed to know when the food was coming up. They'd start what we used to call a stonk, you know, shells and mortars and that. And it was a bit hectic at times. I remember one night we was there, and it was quite dark, and I don't know why, but the Germans started throwing some shells over, and I heard this thud. It was a terrific thud, and I didn't know what it was really till the next morning when it became daylight. There's only a shell about 3 yards from our dugout, it hadn't exploded, and it stayed there all the time. And we often used to say, "I hope that thing don't go off," you know. And lost another good corporal there. He got a direct Corporal Tannock, his name was. He got a mortar bomb directly into his dugout and just blew him in half, you know. Fred Hartle, my old sergeant, tried to pick him up, but it was a bit awkward, you know. And they were going to just bury him in the trench, you know, just cover him over in the trench, and the sergeant wouldn't have it. He says, "No way," you know. And they managed to get him out of the trench, and he was taken away for a temporary burial. I was there last year. I visited Corporal Tannock's grave. He's buried in this little cemetery at Overloon, amongst a lot more King's Own Scottish Borderers. I made a cross by hand and took it up there, put our names on, you know. It's still there. It was still there last year, the cross. And our job after that was to capture Venray, because Smack come under the council of Venray, the small village, you know. I remember one day a section of B Company went over in broad daylight. I don't know why, because, I mean, crossing open ground in daylight, you know, it's very awkward. I know who'd give the order. But I see him going across, because we were standing in this dugout, which was right on the edge of the woods, and they got over there. But the Germans must have let him into the village, and they ambushed him, you know. I think there was only two chaps came back. Oh, I believe one had stood on a shoe mine as well going in there. You know, they used to have these little shoe mines that just blow your foot off. One of them had his foot blown off, and another chap came back. Now, he was another Geordie lad. This was B Company. And Sid Burns was his name. Good entertainer, tap dancing and all that sort of thing, you know, quite a lad. And Sid came back, what we call bomb happy. He'd lost his nerve and everything, you know. And later on, I heard he had the centre part of his hair had gone grey, just completely grey, where it should have been black, you know. Yes, so the Germans had ambushed them, and we lost quite a lot of men, you know. And this little, I mean, it was only a little village, but, oh, it was shocking the amount of trouble they gave us, you know. The patrols used to come out from there, and, of course, if you did send a reconnaissance platoon in, and they did get back, they said there's no one in there. But when you sent, when you did send a bigger party in, you know, they used to massacre them. Actually, I've been back there since, and I've been back to where my dugout was at the end of the woods. It's all filled in now, of course, and there's a little side road there. But the other two brigades had, our job was to clear the woods, which was adjacent to Venray and Overloon, and we had a hell of a job clearing these woods because there was everything there. There was shoe mines, there was spanders, there was everything, you know. And we did lose quite a lot of men. It was really hectic. And the other two brigades went in and they captured Venray and Overloon. So I've been back to Venray. My friend, who's the chairman, he's the chairman of Market Garden now. He's a Dutchman. He took me back this year with the old sergeant and another friend of mine from the Kingsland Scottish Borderers, and we met the mayor of Venray, and we thanked him for the monument they built just outside of the little village of Smacht. It's the base is the 3rd Div sign, and there's a lot of metalwork on it which depicts these houses that had been destroyed in that. And there's also names of the civilians who were killed while the Germans were in there. We visited that and laid a wreath, and then we went to thank the mayor for the monument and one thing and another, and I present them with a tire clip from the Market Garden Association. After that, we were pulled out, and we had a rest. And then the next thing was we went through the Siegfried Line into Germany. And our next big do was at Bremen in Germany.
Can you tell me about going through the Siegfried Line, please?
Yeah, we there wasn't much opposition there, you know, there wasn't much opposition at all there, because I think the Germans had enough by that time, because there was still the odd problem of snipers and that, you know, but nothing like what it was previously. And as I say, the next thing, we went into Bremen. We captured the German barracks in Bremen, and we held the barracks for, we were supposed to be relieved by, I think it was the South, I'm not sure if it was the Yorks or the Lancs that was going to relieve us, but anyway, we held the German barracks. We were supposed to be relieved within 2 hours, but we weren't, and in the meantime the Germans counterattacked. And Fred, well, there was, I think there was about 8 left in our section, and there was only 2 of us come out of it in one piece, like, you know. Fred got his arm all shot up. Actually, Fred was mentioned in dispatches because he was a bit of a lad, you know. I remember, I forgot to tell you that when we were in Holland, We were sent to Wonsum to relieve the Ulster Rifles. This was on the River Maas in Holland. And the Ulster Rifles had one of their officers and his batman kidnapped. The Germans came over the river one night and took him prisoner, these, you know. Anyway, we took over from them at Wonsum. And we used to do these fighting patrols because it was heavy snow in that. And I used to, well, Fred and our team used to be, we used to do it every night, this fire and betrayal. We used to wear snowsuits. And I knew all the route. I'd be doing it every night down to the river. I knew all the route, where the trip wires were and this sort of thing, you know. And this night, I remember we came to this big farmhouse.